Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me in the Bettors Box. This is BettingTheBook.com's MLB Betting Podcast for Monday, April 30th. I'm your host, Adam Burke. This and every edition of the Bettors Box presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. You sign up at DSI using that promo code BANG200, you'll get 100% deposit match bonus for the Sportsbook and 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Happy to be with you for another week here on Bang the Book Radio. We'll have the Bettors Box on Monday and Thursday this week. Should be doing a Kentucky Derby podcast with Brian Blessing. Not sure if that'll be on Tuesday or Wednesday here of this week. Probably Wednesday because we won't have the post draws until later on in the week. Could even be later than that. I'll just have to coordinate with Brian and see what his schedule looks like. But he will have a couple of videos over on our YouTube page this week about his thoughts on the Derby, and also some general horse racing tips with, you know, some of the betting options that are available, some of the things that you want to look for when trying to handicap the ponies. So really looking forward to that one. I did an article scouting the top Derby contenders. You can check that out over on the front page at bangthebook.com. And I'll have a little bit more Derby content and also a preview for the Kentucky Oaks as we go throughout the week here. My picks and analysis article for Major League Baseball available every day over at bangthebook.com, as well as my daily fantasy piece. We've got NBA and NHL series previews that we're rolling out. Obviously, the second round for the NHL has already started, but still some good betting tips and information in those. We'll cover golf for this week, also NASCAR, UFC event coming up in 2 weeks' time, but all the odds already out for UFC 224, so probably get that preview written up here this week. Also, while you're over at bangthebook.com, we've got our sportsbook reviews. Check those out with exclusive promo codes and free deposit bonuses for all of our affiliates that are out there. Also, you can get involved in those contests, daily streaker, monthly pick of the day, top monthly win percentage, top ROI, top number of units won. Sign up with an email address. We'll shoot you a daily newsletter, give you an idea of what's going on over at the site. But that will give you access to those contests where you can win cash prizes in those. So check those out over there at bangthebook.com, where we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. As far as today's show goes, we'll have the Monday mailbag. Got a handful of questions here this morning and a few from last week that I could talk about. Then we'll go beyond the box score, take a look down the lines. I'll give you a couple of different picks here for today. And then in lieu of the sabermetric stat, we'll just go ahead and move on to what to watch for here early on in the week. So let's go ahead and start with this week's edition of the Monday mailbag. This question from @SightlessSquirrel on Twitter asking, can you do a bit in one of the pods about how umping rotations work and the nature of umpiring and their influence on game results? So the first part here, very easy question. The umpire rotations. We actually don't know who the umpires are at the start of a series. This is something that's announced a couple of hours before game time. So if you're looking to play on or against specific umpires in the first game of a series, it can be very, very hard to do because we don't have that information available until a short amount of time before the game. However, as the series goes along, umpires move clockwise. So the guy who's behind home plate will go to third. The guy at third will go to second. Second will move to first. So the first base umpire is the guy behind home plate the next day. So that'll give you a little bit of an idea on, you know, what the umpiring rotation is going to be, who's going to wind up working that game. Now, a lot of guys tend to average about 30 games behind the plate per season. I think I saw the highest last year was 36. You have some guys who make cameo appearances, some younger umpires, maybe guys that fill in because of injury or illness or something like that. But you know, overall, you're going to have a lot of the same faces, the same types of guys that'll do 25 to as many as 35 games behind the plate over the course of the season. Now, there are a lot of umpire statistics databases out there. We've got one over at bangthebook.com. I will admit ours is pretty basic overall. So, you know, RotoWire's got a very good one that includes sortable column headings. Also, Swish Analytics has a good one. And they also have a couple of interesting columns that are like K-boost, walk boost, run boost, stuff like that. I presume that's based on the league average for umpires. But there are a lot of databases out there, and I personally don't use them a lot in my handicapping. But to say that they don't have an influence would be completely wrong. You know, you've got guys like C.B. Buckner and Angel Hernandez who, as they're doing a game, nobody knows what the strike zone is. It pisses off the hitters. It pisses off the pitchers. So you can have some interesting outcomes in their games. C.B. Buckner, a very good under umpire last year. I think he was 16 of 23 going under the total on games that didn't push the number. That's largely because no one knows what his strike zone is. He's just a bad umpire overall. And let's be honest, there are a lot of bad umpires out there. It is a hard job. Don't get me wrong. It is a very, very difficult job. But there are a lot of guys out there that are very inconsistent with the strike zones, guys that, you know, just don't make calls correct on the base paths. It's a tough job, but there's no oversight for umpires. The Umpires Union is one of the strongest in professional sports. Quite frankly, the Umpires Union is stronger than a lot of players' unions. There are not a lot of repercussions for guys that do their jobs poorly. So that's kind of more my rant on umpires. Doesn't really have a whole lot of betting impact necessarily. But there are some guys that are good under umpires. I know Doug Eddings is usually a pretty good under umpire. Kyle Hunter uses them a lot in his handicapping. But he does a lot more total stuff than I do. And I think umpires have a much bigger impact on the totals market than they would on the sides market. And that's a pretty obvious thing, to be completely honest with you. Guys that have small zones, you know, if pitchers have to throw it into a strike zone the size of a thimble, runs are going to happen. If umpires have the Greg Maddux circa 1995 strike zone, then you're going to have a lot of low-scoring games. So it is something you can use to your advantage. I tend to look at it in terms of, you know, when you look at catchers who are very good pitch framers, Yan Gomes is one of the best in the league this year. Yasmani Grandal is another one. Austin Hedges is the best in baseball based on the numbers as tracked by Baseball Prospectus. Wilson Ramos down in Tampa Bay is doing very well as well. So you've got an umpire with a big zone. Those are some catchers that can really take advantage. Wellington Castillo, Wilson Contreras, Francisco Cervelli, Drew Butera. These are the guys who aren't doing as well with the framing metrics. So if you've got an umpire that's got a small zone with some of those guys, could be a long day for their pitchers and a long day for those catchers. So, you know, it's not a huge impact in terms of framing strikes. It's, you know, it adds up over time. The aggregate winds up being a few runs or more over the course of the season. A lot of it is more of a mental aspect. You know, pitchers think that they should have gotten a call. They don't get it. You know, obviously they're upset about that. Maybe the inning kind of unravels a little bit. So there is that element to it. And for me, that's not necessarily quantifiable, so I don't dabble in it too much. But again, the most important thing is the first base umpire will move behind the plate. And if you want to handicap umpires, you can do it based on that. At Nate Tommy Nine Dime asking on Twitter here this morning, more of a general question, obviously different for everyone, but from what you see, how long until someone will pull winnings from their bankroll? Is it a month? Is it 2 months? Maybe after winning a certain percentage of your bankroll. Thanks, and absolutely loving the baseball content. I appreciate the kind words there at Nate Tommy Nine Dime. It is a hard question to answer because, again, as you mentioned in your question, as I will mention here, it is a matter of personal preference. You know, for some people, if they get a 10 or 20% boost to their bankroll, they'll take it out. A lot of times people will hold it because, let's be honest, you know, while it's easier than it used to be, it's still a bit of a hassle, a bit of a frustration sometimes to get money from these offshore books. You know, you kind of wonder sometimes where the money's coming from. Do you get a wire? Do you do it in crypto? You know, do you do Western Union, something like that? Do you do some books have a debit card option now as well? You know, sometimes the hassle kind of keeps people away from doing it. But if you need it, you know, if you need $500 for car repair, if you need to make a down payment, something like that, if you hit a big lottery ticket parlay, hell yeah, take some of that money out. And obviously it's different for professionals that are living on it versus those that supplement it versus those that are just out there having fun. And of course, keep in mind here at this time of the year, you know, you probably want to save it for football season anyway, whether you're playing win totals, game of the year lines, or you just want to have it liquid there for when the college football and the NFL season start. So honestly, I don't know. I mean, I've seen people that take it regularly. They basically take it as if they're transferring money from one bank account to another. You know, just a regular set amount pretty much every month. You know, sometimes you see people take a lot of it. Sometimes people will, if they are having a lot of success, you know, a lot of people scared away by, you know, the online poker shutdown. And, you know, a lot of people lost some funds with that or had a very hard time getting their money out when the feds seized those places. So a lot of people don't want to keep a lot of money in these offshore markets. So maybe if they get above $500, they'll pull it, you know, no matter how much it is. They want to keep their risk low in terms of, you know, if something happens with the offshore industry. I think the offshore industry is very, very safe at this point. Again, there's not a lot of oversight, not a lot of regulation with it, but, you know, it's just all a matter of personal preference. I mean, I don't know if you set a goal of, you know, if I get 20% ROI on my bankroll, I want to pull it. You can do that. But one thing I do want our listeners to remember here, and I think this is maybe a more important point for me to answer here on the show, because again, the hard part is people are going to do, you know, a lot of different things with their bankrolls and with their withdrawals. But keep in mind that when you withdraw, you have a smaller bankroll. So if you're somebody that's subscribed to that 3-4-5% system, you know, or maybe a 5-6-7% system, something like that, let's say you're a 5% better with a $1,000 bankroll. Well, if you pull 500 of that, you can't bet 5% anymore, because then all of a sudden that becomes a 10% bet. So you have to adjust properly, and you want to make sure that you're doing that even based on your wins and losses, even if it doesn't have to do with a withdrawal or maybe you make an additional deposit, something like that. You always want to reevaluate what your unit size is going to be, what your bet size will be. It's not going to be static. And if you want to do that on a week-by-week basis or every other week, that's completely up to you. That's your prerogative. But you want to make sure that you're adjusting your bet size accordingly to the size of your bankroll. So if you take that 500 out, you know, 5% is a much different number than it previously was with a $1,000 bankroll. So keep that in mind. That's a very important thing, because what's going to end up happening is invariably, if you don't readjust your bankroll size and you run, or your bet size, excuse me, and you run cold, guess where that 500 you just pulled is going right back to. So that's what you want to keep in mind. You want to make sure that you're regularly evaluating the size of that bankroll. At Rico DeGallo, and again, one of my favorite Twitter handles out there, asking on Twitter, not sure if you've covered this and I missed it, but do you do anything different with MLB doubleheaders? I mean, in terms of my handicapping strategy, it's a lot different, because this is such a unique type of thing. Whether it's a split doubleheader, a day-night doubleheader, a traditional doubleheader, it really doesn't matter to me. I will never play game two until game one is finished. And that's just a given, because I have to see what relievers are used, you know, how the game plays out, things of that sort. You have to double and triple check the pitchers, because teams will announce one thing for game one, one thing for game two, and then realize, oh shit, we should switch these two guys. You know, maybe this guy has a better chance of giving us length in game one. Maybe we'll flip this. Maybe this guy asked to pitch during the day, or, you know, wants to pitch during the day. You know, something, maybe there's a family function, a wife getting ready to give birth. You never know. You never know what the situations are with these doubleheaders until basically the day of the game. So, you know, you really want to double and triple check. You have to see who's in the lineup. If it's a situation where you've got a doubleheader where game one is a righty and game two is a lefty, you have a pretty good idea of how the lineups are going to go. Teams and managers will deploy their platoon assets in a way that makes sense. If you're facing two lefties or two righties, that's a little bit different. Then you kind of have to look at that game one lineup and say, okay, will this guy play again in game two? You know, maybe you've got a 35-year-old guy who excels on the short side of the platoon. It's a doubleheader and they're facing two lefties. The manager probably won't use that guy in both games. Which game will he use him? You want to wait and make sure that you see those lineups before you really get involved. One thing I can tell you, though, is that as a general rule, and I was trying to run that Killer Sports database here this morning to try and figure this out. Somebody smarter than me can do that. I'm inclined to fade the team that wins game one in the second game, because by and large, the goal for every doubleheader, for every team, is to get a split. It is very, very hard to sweep a doubleheader. It's hard to play well for, you know, 18 innings over the course of one day. So if you get that game one win, maybe sometimes you relax a little bit for game two. A lot of times you're going to see doubleheaders that are splits. So that is one betting angle that I kind of consider. Again, it's not a blind blanket thing. I mean, if you've got, you know, let's say you're the White Sox and you lose game one and you got James Shields going in game two, that doesn't mean I'm going to run and back James Shields. I mean, he's awful and we all know that. But, you know, that would be my first inclination, would be, okay, I'm going to look for reasons to go against the team that won game one. If I find enough of them, I will. If I don't find enough of them, I'll generally stay off the game or maybe look for some kind of live betting opportunity. At Brian J. Seymour on Twitter asking, lately I've been purely covering up the money lines and projecting what I think the lines should be in order to find value. It has really presented great value with underdogs. Is there something to keeping advanced metrics in mind, but focusing on the value of the line primarily? And of course there is. I mean, anytime you get any pro that we talk to on this show, or anybody who does this really seriously, is going to say, I bet numbers and not teams. That's just what they're going to say. For me, because I think I've got a really good handle on Major League Baseball, because I use the sabermetrics. I use some of the Statcast data and things like that to my advantage. You know, for me, I want to handicap the teams. I want to handicap the matchups. I want to know exactly what I'm doing. And the best way that I can describe it is sort of like this. You know, think about putting together a puzzle. And every statistic to me is a piece of the puzzle. So for me, I'll put that exterior frame together using sabermetrics. I'll fill in some of the main characters. And then if I don't have the other pieces I need, I'll use probability and likelihood to fill in the rest. But at the same time, I'm looking at the outside of the box. I'm looking to see how this puzzle is supposed to look when it's completed. So something like this here that Brian's talking about, you know, just not even looking at the line at all, it's kind of like starting to put the puzzle together, knowing that you've got some information, but you're not looking at the outside of the box. You know, you're just using the pieces that are there and trying to put it together yourself. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, for me, I like having the guide. I like knowing where the odds makers have put this line, where the line movement has come in. And obviously that's something I can do because we've seen the overnights by the time I write up my article. But, you know, whatever works for you. I mean, I will never tell somebody not to do something if it works for them. I will give them cautionary tales. I will give them, you know, things to think about. But I'm never going to tell somebody, this is how you should handicap. I think my process is good. I think the way that I do things makes a lot of sense. Doesn't work for you. It doesn't work for you. And that's what I like about this show and about the listener counts that I can track with this show is that I know everybody listening to this show doesn't believe in the advanced metrics to the degree that I do. I know that everybody listening to this show is not using ERA and XFIP to handicap or not using the Statcast data or exit velocities or whatever else. But you're open-minded about it. And I'm always open-minded about any suggestion that people give out. I will tell you if I don't think that it's going to work long-term, and I will tell you, you know, you want to reevaluate this type of thing. And that's what I would tell Brian here is that it may work long-term. There's certainly a possibility with that. But you don't want to develop hubris about it because a lot of things in betting are tried and true over long-term sample sizes. I think my process is I've done it this way for 5 or 6 years now. I've had, you know, a good amount of success doing it. In small sample sizes, anything can work. So you're off to a good start with this. But again, you want to make sure that you're constantly tweaking and adjusting. Are you incorporating recency bias when you're considering the lines? Are you taking that out? Are you looking at it as more of a pure handicap, ignoring some of the noise? You know, that would be my follow-up question here is, you know, what are you doing? What are you using to predict the line? Are you looking at common opponents, quote unquote? Are you sort of looking at, you know, areas where you've got similar pitchers or similar teams? You know, are you looking at line histories to see what the odds look like for those types of things? You know, I'll admit, I've got a feel for the market. I've done this for a while. I've studied lines. I have an idea generally of where I expect them to be. And maybe that's just the case with Brian here. Maybe he's just doing something like that. But again, like anything else, and this is a lot like the power ratings discussion I had for college football, I regularly had teams that were off. I was just off on teams. I was not evaluating them properly. Pushed me towards playing those teams or second-guessing my line value. I was never fully sure what I wanted to do in that situation. So, again, you constantly have to tweak and adjust. And this is just another one of those examples where there are a lot of different ways to do this. There are a lot of paths to making money when it comes to handicapping. But you have to be able to make those adjustments when necessary. You have to realize that you need to adapt and you need to evolve because the market is always evolving. Handicappers should always be evolving. The second you get complacent, that's when you set yourself up to fail. If you're constantly looking for new information and looking for new angles and trying to understand different things, that's all you can do. You want to do that. You want to consistently try to improve. If you get to a point where you feel like you've got it all figured out, you're in for a rude awakening. So very long-winded answer here to this question, and obviously I kind of took it in a little bit of a different direction, but there's nothing wrong with covering up the lines and you know, going and guessing what you think they should be. You know, this is something that a lot of people do. A lot of guys, and I do this with college football, I will put together my power ratings lines before the numbers come out because I want to get a feel for what I think, and then I'll see how they match up with the rest of the market. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Nothing wrong with that at all whatsoever. But again, you just want to make sure that you're tweaking your formula. If you want to use the advanced metrics after the fact, that's fine. If you don't want to use the advanced metrics at all, that's fine as well. You know, but again, I will never stunt anybody's creativity with how they're doing things. I will, again, I will suggest different things. I will tell you that, you know, hey, you want to make sure that if this works in a small sample size, try to do what you can to improve the sustainability of it. But, you know, again, like I said, there's just so many different ways of going about this. And if that's what works for you, if coming up with your own numbers works for you and you find underdog value or favorite value or whatever else, closing line value is important. Is it always going to win? No, it's not. But it's very important because it's a good predictor of future success. And again, I talk about predictors of future success for pitchers here on the show all the time. Being able to get closing line value is a predictor of future success for you in the betting market. And a good email question here, and I love getting emails and feedback from our listeners, adam@bangthebook.com, so feel free to send those over whenever you get the opportunity. This question comes from Josh via email here, and his question is, you know, feel free to paraphrase, but I'll go ahead and read it almost word for word here. It says, in prior shows on football and basketball, you recommend not varying bet amounts significantly between games. There, you're mostly dealing with lines around minus 110. In a money line sport like baseball, though, do you adjust your bet dealing with lines around minus 110? Or do you adjust your bet? Because obviously you've got, you know, minus 140s, you've got plus 140s, things of that sort. So, you know, sort of a question here in terms of how to bet with those bigger favorites, with those bigger dogs. And for me, I like round numbers, you know, and this is just me overall. Maybe it's my OCD or something like that. Like, I hate carrying loose change, for example. I would rather have $0 than 87 cents. I just don't care to carry around loose change. You know, go to whatever donation bin is there. It'll go in my wife's purse, and 6 weeks later, she'll have $18 worth of loose change in her purse. But, you know, for me, I just like the round numbers. So if I'm playing a minus 140, it'll be, for example, 140 to win 100, 70 to win 50, you know, whatever the bet size is. Now, if I'm playing small dogs, up to about plus 125, plus 130 area, I will bet one full unit on those. I think one of my greatest edges from a betting standpoint comes on playing those small dogs, the plus 115s, the plus 120s. I think, you know, in terms of tracking what I've done here throughout my handicapping career, that would be my highest ROI. Those are about 45% propositions there. I think plus 125 is about 44.44%. Plus 130 is about 43.5%. I'm okay with that. My risk profile will tell me that if I'm in the plus 125, plus 130 range, I'll go ahead and put a full unit on it to win 1.25, 1.3. Something bigger than that, that's probably a situation where I'll bet X to win one unit. So, you know, X to win $100 or X to win $200 or whatever the case may be when you get some of those bigger underdogs. Just, you know, again, I mean, it's all up to your personal preference and risk management. I'm not a Kelly guy. I'm not a model guy. So I don't know what exactly my, you know, perceived edge is to then bet accordingly based on Kelly. But, you know, again, for me, that's what I'm comfortable with. If that works for you, that works for you as well. But, you know, for favorites in any capacity, I'll basically bet X to win one unit. And then for dogs, you know, at plus 125, plus 130, I'll bet one unit to win 1.25, 1.3, whatever the case may be. But then above and beyond that, if I got a minus or a plus 150, a plus 200, I'm just looking to get one unit of a win out of that. At MikeyDFS86 with an email question here, because this one's a little bit more in-depth, says, as you know, I read your write-ups every day as I do not have time to break down the card. However, I'd like to break down the card 1 to 2 times a week, but he's only able to use his cell phone in order to break down the card. So the questions he's asking here, he knows the resources that I use, the ones I talk about here on the show, FanGraphs, Baseball Prospectus, Baseball Reference, Baseball Savant, StatCast, Roster Resource, BullpenPress.com/bullpen usage. Basically asking, what site do you start with here? What site is the easiest to navigate on a cell phone? What is your step-by-step process? And I will tell you, from trying to use these sites mobile, whether I'm at Indians games or at a bar or on the golf course trying to figure out some of these stats, these sites are largely not mobile-friendly. I can tell you that right away. Savant is probably the most mobile-friendly one right now, but that's because that's MLB Advanced Media, and you know they're going to put a little bit more emphasis on that. FanGraphs is not very user-friendly as a mobile site. It just isn't. You know, you have to do a lot of zooming in and zooming out with the player pages. The articles are fine. The articles are very easy to read, but the player pages can be a pretty big challenge to say the least. Baseball Reference, a lot of it on the mobile site, as I'm sure you know, is contained in drop-down menus. So it's not bad. It's organized well. But, you know, again, anything that's got large tables like FanGraphs, like Baseball Reference, going to be hard to use from a mobile standpoint. I will say this. On FanGraphs, underneath the Scores tab, there's a link that says Probable Pitchers that will give you all of the guys expected to start that night. That helps in navigating the site. You don't have to use the search bar. If there's multiple pitchers that have similar names, that can be a real pain in the ass. So that Probable Pitchers page underneath the Scores tab can be very, very helpful for FanGraphs. I love the game feed for StatCast. You can get live exit velocity data with that. So maybe that has some live betting upside to it. But the steps that I go through here, and again, I do this all on a computer with two screens, which is very, very important. If you've got a computer set up and a desk big enough, get yourself a second monitor. It is a lifesaver. So my steps, first I look at the odds screen because I want to determine what games I'm writing about. Sometimes personally, I'll play big favorites or big dogs that I don't talk about in the article, but I understand that readers, by and large, don't want to do that. Now, we had the talk last week about how good minus 180 and higher favorites are doing, but still, a lot of people don't feel like they have the bankroll capacity for that. I'm not going to use a lot of words on those in the write-ups. Those write-ups take me a lot of time to do, and a lot of people aren't going to play minus 180 plus favorites. They're not going to use plus 200 favorite underdogs, stuff like that. So, you know, for me, first and foremost, it's about keeping my readers in mind and what they're going to be interested in. So that's what I do. I sort of go through the card and look at the games. They're going to be in there. Then I have multiple tabs open. Like I said, two screens, just absolutely great. I recommend it very, very much. For FanGraphs, I open up both pitcher pages. Away will be first. Home will be second. In the middle, I'll have a miscellaneous tab to sort batting splits, stuff like that. For Savant, I'll have the exit velocity leaderboard up and the search page. The bullpen usage sites at the end. Organization is really key, and this is a very important element for a handicapper. You have to be organized. Whether you've got Twitter lists of beat writers, whether you've got pages bookmarked, you've got all your bets tracked, you know, you have your sports books lined up, your odds screen organized with the sports books that you have at the forefront. This stuff is very, very important. Very important because you're looking at a lot of data, and that is one thing that, Mikey mentions here in his email is that it's overwhelming, and I completely agree. It is very overwhelming. So if you've got structure, if you've got organization, that is something that can really, really help streamline the process for you, can be extremely beneficial, to say the least. So that Probable Pitchers page at FanGraphs will be a great help for you to do this mobile. That if you've got a StatCast tab up with the leaderboard at a minimum, I think that's something that will be really helpful for you as well. It's very, very tough to do on a phone. It just is what it is. Maybe see if you can get a tablet with your phone plan, something like that. But again, organization is so big. It's just such a key for me. And I mean, I'm a comfort zone person. I'm a routine oriented person. So I need it more than others. You know, if I've got some of those external distractions, it can be hard for me to handicap the card. I kind of get into my bubble and that's where I want to stay. But again, you got to experiment and find out what works for you if you want to try to break down the card. And like I said, I mean, the FanGraphs player pages can be tough to use on a mobile site. So not optimal, but if you really want to do it, you just have to find a way to do it. I mean, that's pretty much the only way that I can describe it here on today's show. All right, let's go ahead and go beyond the box score, and we'll talk about the Seattle Mariners taking 3 of 4 from the Cleveland Indians. I told you Seattle was in a position to get hot. I thought that they were a play-on team here in the near future. Turns out it was against my Cleveland Indians. I do want to point out, as I had a lot of people reach out to me on Twitter and a lot of people texting me yesterday with the first inning sack bunt from Bradley Zimmer, the Indians sack bunted in the first 3 innings of 2 Josh Tomlin starts this past week, 10 runs in both of them. Poetic, fitting, stupid decision-making by Lindor and Zimmer. Bunting sucks, hit dingers. That's all I can say about that. 32 runs for Seattle in this series, at least 5 in every game. Clevinger wasn't too bad on Thursday, but regression did hit him very quickly. In the span of like 4 hitters, he gave up 4 runs. It was real ugly there in the middle innings for him. But you know, this Indians offense is a big-time problem at this point. They hit 5 solo home runs on Friday. 11 of their 18 runs in this series came via the long ball. They're tied for 3rd in solo home runs. They're 9th in home runs with men on base. However, they have a 217 average with a 293 on base. a 375 slash or a 375 slugging. They're not walking. Without Carlos Santana, they're not walking. They're not built to hit left-handed pitching. They're batting 220 with a 288 on base, 371 slugging against lefties. They get another lefty here tonight in Cole Hamels. But they hit five of those home runs off of Erasmo Ramirez in this series, and they're just a mess right now. And with Andrew Miller hurt, the bullpen is in very, very tough shape. Thursday night, three innings, two hits, one run, one walk, one strikeout. Cody Allen came in, gave up the three-run homer on Friday. That, I mean, it was his fault to hang a pitch like that to Mike Zunino, but Terrence Francona with just awful game management in the late innings for that one brings Kluber out over 100 pitches, lets him throw 116, then pulls him one out from the complete game. Cody Allen probably not expecting to come in at that point. Just a big mess there in that one. But then the Indians pen on Saturday. Carlos Carrasco leaves early, tweaked his back. Six innings for the bullpen, seven runs allowed on seven hits. Couple of walks, couple of strikeouts, gave up four runs in three innings on Sunday. That was Nick Goody, who needs to be a primary guy for this bullpen now. Real bad look for that Indians bullpen. They're a tough team to play right now as a big favorite. They're not hitting. They're not built to hit lefties. They're not sustaining, you know, innings. They're not creating a lot of opportunities. It's kind of a bloop and a blast or a line drive single and a blast kind of thing. Right now with them, it is very, very hard, and it is tough for me to watch right now. It really is. The bunting, the bullpen, it's hard. It's just hard to watch right now. But on the Mariners side of things, they're still an over team to me. This offense is very, very good. This rotation, not so much. Marco Gonzalez was great on Sunday. Paxton was good. Mike Leake still gives up a lot of hard contact. Erasmo Ramirez is not a guy. And also, D. Gordon in center field is a disaster. Bad. I give the dude credit for going out there. And, you know, obviously it's not a position that he's ever played before. Now he's in his mid-30s, but it just looks bad. It is not a good look. So they are an over team in just about every facet right now. How about the scrappy Miami Marlins? They pick up that big series win in Los Angeles. I think they were about a plus 350 dog in that series. Then they go home, lose the opener to Colorado 1-0, come back and win the next two games. Really impressive there for the Marlins, who have only won eight games so far this season, but they're a scrappy team, man. They are really out there scratching and clawing for some wins. But this Rockies team, man, is this offense bad. Two runs in this series off of Marlins pitching, just brutal. Just absolutely brutal. Against lefties, they're trotting out Ian Desmond in the two hole. Not a good look. They get another lefty tonight, by the way, in John Lester. Chad Bettis is still a fade guy. Pitched pretty well in that start yesterday. Only 82.6 mile per hour average exit velocity. Good start for him, but the numbers still don't look real great. The Rockies bullpen, I'm very worried about that. Brian Shaw looks broken. The numbers are terrible. 22 pitches in yesterday's game. Two swings and misses, which is not Brian Shaw-like. Only called strikes. The velocity is fine. The command is totally non-existent at this point. Adam Ottavino is going to pitch a ton. And Adam Ottavino is a guy with Tommy John in his past. Hopefully he's able to stay together, because this Rockies team, the bullpen is all they've got right now. John Gray is a good starter. Tyler Anderson pitched well in this series, but their rotation is pretty iffy. The lineup is not good. The bullpen is really all they've got. And with Shaw broken, even that's watered down a little bit here. For the Marlins, I told you to keep an eye on Caleb Smith. And Caleb Smith now, back-to-back really good starts, 19 swings and misses in this one across his six innings. Very, very impressive outing for him. High strikeout, high walk guy. He's very Ian Snell and Sean Newcomb-like. So that's a guy, especially against lineups that can't hit lefties, that's a guy you want to keep a close eye on. I do like this Marlins pen. Teyron Guerrero's got some stuff. I mentioned this on Thursday's show. Drew Steckenrider's got stuff. Kyle Bearclaw's very, very good. Brad Ziegler's a little bit weak, but they've got some hard throwers in middle relief. They might be a decent live betting team, honestly. If they've got a lead, I think they will protect a lot of them. So that may be an angle you want to look at there with the Marlins. Maybe if they're down by a run in the middle innings, take some shots with them in the plus 250, plus 300 range. That may wind up having some value for you over the course of the season. Things are bad for the Minnesota Twins right now. The Cincinnati Reds win that series. If you played that series price that I mentioned Thursday's show, good for you with that one. But the Reds scored 24 runs in this series. since Byron Buxton went out. Byron Buxton last played on April 12th, had migraines, missed the game, last game in Puerto Rico. Then the entire weekend was rained out. Then he winds up getting a hairline fracture in his toe, and he's out indefinitely. Just bad luck for this dude. But the Twins, since April 13th, have allowed more than 10 runs three times, 8 runs four times, 7 runs once, and 6 runs once. They've allowed 7.5 runs per game since Byron Buxton last played. Now, not all of that is because Byron Buxton's not out there, but this is a pitching staff with very, very thin margins for error, and Buxton is a dude who's a 2-win player defensively at a minimum. He means so much to this ball club. They took off in the second half last year when he picked it up offensively, but team defense was the biggest reason they went from losing 103 games in 2016 to being a wild card team last year. Without Buxton, they are a severely watered down defensive ball club. Offensively, 34 at bats with runners in scoring position in this series, but defensively, they're going to give up a lot of runs. This pitching staff is not good. So the Twins have already been an over team this season. I think that continues as we go forward here. Offensively, they've got a lot of guys who have track records who are pretty good hitters. They will figure this thing out. The pitching staff, I'm not confident in at all. And without Buxton, without that safety net out there in center field, they're in trouble. So the Twins are definitely an over team right now, as far as I'm concerned. Well, the Reds won this series and scored 24 runs. Luis Castillo, 1+ innings in the opener, 5 runs on 6 hits, didn't strike anybody out. Velocity is down. Command is gone. It's a tough situation for Castillo right now. And the Reds don't have pitching depth. So I'll be curious to see if they, you know, have him go through growing pains at the big league level, if they send him down and try and get him fixed a little bit. But right now, it's not a good look for Luis Castillo, to say the least. Real quickly here, I want to mention a really good series win for the Atlanta Braves as they took 2 of 3 from the Philadelphia Phillies. This offense is legit, man. Ozzie Albies, Ender Inciarte, Ronald Acuna Jr., Nick Markakis is elevating the ball a little bit more. Kurt Suzuki and Tyler Flowers, pretty good catching tandem when both of those guys are healthy. This is a real good-looking ball club. You know, Inciarte has already got 13 steals. They've got a good offensive yard at SunTrust Park. This is a legit Braves team. I don't know if this is a playoff-caliber team right now because that starting rotation is still a little bit iffy, but they're going to score a lot of runs against average or below-average pitching. The Braves are a team to keep a close eye on right now, and they did get steamed in this series quite frequently. They got steamed in Sunday's game, which they wound up winning. One of the things about the Phillies, though, and I've talked about this before, is that they're going to struggle with pitch-to-contact guys. They draw a lot of walks, highest BB percentage in baseball throughout most of the month of April here. They were able to wait on Julio Teheran. He only worked 3 innings, didn't pitch very well. But Mike Foltynewicz was efficient, 91 pitches in 6 innings. Brandon McCarthy, he's a pitch-to-contact guy, 5 1/3 solid innings, did walk 3. But when you get these pitch-to-contact guys for the Phillies, I think it's a problem for them. And it feels like teams are a little bit more predictable this season than they have been in past years. You know, the Indians don't hit lefties. The Phillies are going to struggle against pitch-to-contact guys. The A's are going to get steamed every time they face a lefty. A lot of predictability this year in terms of line moves and trends on a team-specific level. But that's one I noticed with the Phillies here, and what I will continue to look to play against going forward is that if they have guys that force you to put the ball in play, they're going to struggle. Let's go down the lines here, talk about some line moves that we've seen since I was last on the air on Thursday. On Friday, we saw Chris Tillman money. That was the day after Andrew Kashner money, or Andrew Kashner money also came in this weekend on Saturday. So the Orioles are taking some money here, and they are 3-8 against teams with a losing record. That's the worst record in baseball. So maybe the market kind of expecting some positive regression for Baltimore here. Could have also just been a fade of Detroit, which I certainly understand. Detroit has overachieved all of my expectations so far. But Baltimore taking on money with Tillman and Kashner, very, very interesting, to say the least. Blake Snell took some money against the Red Sox and Drew Pomerantz. Blake Snell is a dude, man. That kid is pitching his ass off. He has definitely got a back for the Rays. And for the Rays here, you know, good winning streak for them. Their starting rotation, they've got some starting pitching that can work. You know, Jake Faria hasn't really gotten it going yet, but Snell has pitched well. Archer is, you know, obviously Chris Archer, he's got dynamic stuff, could go out there and win you a game any day of the week. The Rays are getting some good starting pitching right now. The offense has come around. The bullpen is still a big question mark, but Blake Snell is a guy you can back with some level of confidence here. So I'll move on. The Angels against the Yankees on Friday night. Yankees won that game anyway, wound up sweeping Anaheim in that series. It was a bad travel spot, plus Andrew Heaney showing some signs of positive regression from an ERA to xFIP standpoint. Money came in on the Angels. Didn't work out, though. Money against Hyunjin Ryu and the Dodgers on Friday. That was with Derek Holland on the hill for the Giants. Derek Holland has not been good, but he's been steamed multiple times so far this year. I sort of wonder, with these guys who were really awful last season, like a Tillman, like a Holland, does the market just kind of play them almost on principle? Just looking at those lines and saying, okay, they were bad last year, but this year, you know, there's some recency bias incorporated in the number. Maybe that's the case. I'm not running to back any of those really bad pitchers, but this one did work out as Holland and the Giants were a winner. We had 17 games on Saturday, a couple of doubleheaders. Just touch on some of the line moves here. Saw a big fade of Chris Stratton and the Giants. Stratton did not pitch well. That was game one of the doubleheader. There were regression signs, and I talked about those in my picks analysis piece. When you look at regression, when you look at the expectation of regression, sometimes it's immediate, sometimes it's gradual. For Stratton there, it was very immediate. He gave up six runs, did not last long in that game. I'd come back on him in his next start, because once you get that regression out of the way, you know, usually a pitcher kind of levels off a little bit, pitches more toward his true talent level. I think Stratton's a guy with a pretty high talent level, as I've talked about in some of my recent write-ups. So money coming against Jaime Garcia, that was to back Bartolo Colon. Jaime Garcia has allowed a ton of hard contact this year. I made a mistake. I streamed him in a fantasy league against Texas on Saturday. Then after the fact, I went and looked. I'd already picked him up, went and looked at the Savant data to do my write-up or to do my my DFS piece for Saturday, and I noticed all the hard contact, and I still left him out there. He got knocked around. The exit velocity metrics are important, especially if you look at the guys who have the highest exit velocities on fly balls and line drives. Those are the guys that are going to get hit hard. High-velocity ground balls are one thing. High-velocity balls hit in the air that can go for extra base hits and home runs are another thing. Those are problematic. That's something I've tried to look at a lot in my daily fantasy piece here lately, and something I've been trying to mention a little bit more in my write-up. So if you go to Savant, go to the pitching leaderboard, you know, about 50 batted ball events is what you want to put as your search parameter there. If you sort the highest exit velocities by fly ball and line drive, those guys have all been pretty bad here throughout the year. And if they haven't been bad, they're going to be bad very, very soon. Chad Bettis is a guy up on that list, for example. So that's a pretty good, easy indicator of looking at pitchers that are going to struggle. It's over at baseballsavant.com, pitching leaderboard, sort the pitcher exit velocities by fly ball and line drive, average exit velocity. You'll find some guys that are in line for some tough outings here coming up. So money on the Braves on Saturday and Sunday, again, as I mentioned in that series against the Phillies. And they're a buy team for the market. They're a buy team for me right now as well. Money came in against Trevor Williams and the Pirates on Saturday. Trevor Williams, a guy I talked about in my write-up, he's a league average kind of guy, maybe a little bit better than that. The market hates him for some reason. I like him. I think there's some value in backing Trevor Williams. Once you wait it out, wait for the market to go ahead and go against him and then play back at that number as we get closer to first pitch. Saturday, we did see that Andrew Cashner move, and he got rocked. Saw a big Lance McCullers move. That was against the Oakland A's. Tough right-hander for the A's. Not a big surprise to see that money there. Joey Lucchesi taking money again for San Diego. He's been terrific. They hung a big number in that one. Gave him a lot of run support against Jason Vargas. You might want to hit his numbers early and then decide if you want to play back or not. Again, this down-the-line segment is all about looking for line value, understanding line moves, looking for opportunities. We've had a lot of them here that have continued to play out show after show with some of these specific pitchers. Sunday, again, money on Baltimore. That was Kevin Gausman. Market probably fading the Tigers, but again, I think Baltimore is a team that people expect to get a little bit better here as we move forward. Some money coming in on Jay Happ. He went up to a minus 250 favorite for the Blue Jays, an easy winner there for the market. Money came in against Josh Tomlin. The market was right. Against Chad Bettis, market was right. Braves money, market was right. Market was right a lot on Sunday, to say the least. Robbie Ray went down for the Diamondbacks, pitched an inning and a third, went down with an oblique. We saw money coming on Ray and the Diamondbacks there in that one. That did not work out. But one thing I do want to mention here about Washington, I think Washington's a buy team right now. They are 1-8 in one-run games this season. The offense has really not gotten it going. They're too talented of a team to be playing like this. I think the time to buy is on them right now. Now, of course, that's a little bit challenging because as you look ahead here, you know, they're going to be playing some tough series coming up. But I think the time is now to look to back Washington because this is a pretty decent bullpen that doesn't have the results in one-run games. They've got a good starting rotation. They've got a high upside offense. They're not playing up to it right now. I think Washington is a team that could go on a run here very, very soon. Look at some line moves from Monday. I think we'll start to see money come in against the Indians on Monday. They're facing another lefty, as I mentioned, in Cole Hamels. Trevor Bauer going for the Indians in that one. Seeing John Lester and the Cubs steamed into a bigger favorite. Colorado's offense is bad. They're bad against lefties, so not a big surprise to see that money there. Jameson Taillon taking money for the Pirates. Taillon's been knocked around in his last two outings, but again, when you look at guys with track records, guys with good stuff, if those two starts happen in June, nobody says a word about it. Because they happen in April and they skew his numbers, people want to jump ship. This is a guy that was getting a lot of talk as being, you know, Garrett Cole's replacement, Pittsburgh's new ace. Then he gets shelled for a couple starts and everyone kind of discards him. Maybe today is the bounce back day for Taillon, but again, he's facing the Nationals, who I think are in line to go on a little bit of a run here in the near future. Seeing money against Julius Chacin and the Milwaukee Brewers. I don't know how the market justifies backing Brandon Finnegan, but I do like the over here. Chacin, very, very big platoons. Lefties have hammered him. The Reds have a lot of left-handed hitters. It's a good matchup for the Cincinnati offense, which is probably the reason behind the line move, but I'm not buying Brandon Finnegan at all. So I think the over is the way to look there. Maybe first five over if you want to take the Brewers bullpen out of the equation, but I think we do get some runs in the Queen City tonight. See a little bit of a fade of Jake Arrieta. Philly's getting faded a little bit. I think the Phillies kind of peaked a little bit per the betting market, and then now the market looking to go against them as they did most of the weekend there against the Atlanta Braves. Money coming in against Tampa Bay as their winning streak got snapped yesterday. They had won 8 in a row, but I'm not interested in Jordan Zimmermann at all. My pick for today, along with the over in that Brewers-Reds game, I like the Blue Jays. I'm going to go against the line move here in this one. The Blue Jays are now a dog. You can get them in the plus 105, plus 110 range. I love Aaron Sanchez. Big Aaron Sanchez fan. I don't love Lance Lynn. I've talked about Lance Lynn being a guy that you can back against right-handed heavy lineups. But right now, Lynn is struggling across the board. Rolled his ankle in his last start, so we'll see if there's any residual impact with that. But, you know, I just think that until this Twins offense gets going, and they did have a lot of opportunities against the Reds, didn't cash in on as many of them as they would like to, guys like Sanchez are not a good matchup. He's got the swing and miss, lots of ground balls. You know, if you're running well and you get a ground ball pitcher and you start stringing some of those together, that's great. The Twins aren't stringing much together right now. They're getting chances. They're not cashing in. So I'm hoping that continues for at least one more day. I will take Toronto here today with Aaron Sanchez on the bump against Lance Lynn now that they're a dog. And another pick, a little bonus pick here. I'm going to take Houston. I'm going to lay that big number tonight. Yankees off of a sweep. They're playing about as well as anybody right now in Major League Baseball. Their run differential the last 10 games or so is absolutely phenomenal. But this is a tough spot. You got into Houston very, very early in the morning. Sonny Gray is on the mound, and he's been awful. It's just not a good spot for the Yankees right now. I'll take Charlie Morton and the Astros. I think they come out victorious here tonight. Again, a little bit of a bigger price, minus 155, minus 160 range, but I think they are the play in that game tonight. Quick little look ahead here at some series that'll begin either today or tomorrow. You got the Braves and Mets. Day off for both of these teams on Monday. Sean Newcomb, Noah Syndergaard Tuesday, Julio Teheran, Jacob deGrom on Wednesday, Mike Foltynewicz, Steven Matz on Thursday. The Braves offense getting Syndergaard and deGrom. Good test here for them. I'll be curious to see how they fare. I like Newcomb in that first game. I don't like Teheran in any game. So we'll see, you know, what those lines look like tomorrow. But Mike Foltynewicz in the finale could be a pretty interesting spot there for the Braves. If you want to throw a bone on a series price, they have the advantage, I think, in Thursday's game. So you would really need them to steal one of the first two against Syndergaard or DeGrom. Syndergaard would be an amazing pitcher, by the way. But against Syndergaard or DeGrom there in those first two. But again, I think the Braves offensively stack up very, very well. So what do they do with two premier right-handers? Well, let's find out. Dodgers, Diamondbacks. These two teams have already played six times this season. Arizona is 5-1 to start the year. You got Ross Stripling, Zach Greinke in the first one. Clayton Kershaw, Matt Cook in the second one. Hyunjin Ryu, Zach Godley in the third one, and then finally Alex Wood and Patrick Corbin in the fourth one. Diamondbacks are going to have to find a replacement now for Robbie Ray. That will probably be Braden Shipley, who would pitch Friday against Houston. But 10 of the first 10 of 19 games in this season series already going to be finished by Thursday. Unbelievable. That's absolutely crazy. The market is expecting Arizona to level off. I think you will see Dodgers money in all of the games of this series, with the exception of probably the Ryu and Godley game. I think the market may fade Patrick Corbin on Thursday to back Alex Wood. Mostly looking at Arizona regression. Arizona's only allowed 33 runs in 12 home games. So maybe that's the impact of the humidor. But the market wants to fade Arizona. The market wants to back the Dodgers. I think we see that come through here in this series. Now, does it work out? I don't know. The Dodgers' offense right now is very concerning to me. Clayton Kershaw is not as sharp as he has been in the past. So I don't love the Dodgers in this situation, but I will be watching the market very, very closely in this series. Then, of course, one more serious talk about the four-gamer down in Houston. Sonny Gray, Charlie Morton, the first one tonight. Jordan Montgomery, Justin Verlander Tuesday. Luis Severino, Dallas Keuchel Wednesday. Masahiro Tanaka, Lance McCullers on Thursday. Is this another ALCS preview? Very well could be. Yankees, will they have enough energy and emotion? They've been playing very, very well. Very well. And for Houston, the West is a lot better this year, which should keep them engaged over the course of the season. But it can be tough in the month of April. And they're off to a great start. Kudos to them for that. But it can be tough to go from that playoff intensity, that playoff enthusiasm, to the grind and the rigors of the regular season. This is a series for them to get invested in. This is a series for them to get really involved in. Six, you know, impressive starters in this series with Morton, Verlander, Severino, Keuchel, Tanaka, McCullers. I like Jordan Montgomery. Very high number of breaking balls. Lots of curveballs and changeups from him. How do the Astros fare against that setup? Should be a good series. I don't know if I'm going to have too many thoughts on it because I really want to watch this one as a fan of the game and get a good feel for both of these teams. But that's your premier series this week and the one that will get a lot of buzz. So we'll just have to wait and see how these two teams play things out. Again, I'm hoping to do a Kentucky Derby podcast here this week. We'll wait until after the post draws are done, and then we can give you some better thoughts with that. But lots of great stuff going on over at bangthebook.com, as always. So be sure to check that out. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And remember that you will never strike out when you're in the better's box.